All rise. Court is now in session.
A verdict in this case has already been decided, but I'd like to examine this case together. And then I would like you to ask yourself, what if? What if this person really is innocent? What if the jury got it wrong? Could this crime have occurred as the state said it did? I suppose it's possible. But isn't it also possible that this is one of the many wrongful convictions throughout the United States? Prepare yourself to be amazed, disappointed, and perhaps outraged at what you're about to hear. I'm Deborah Fulton, Case Review Manager for Wrongful Convictions News. And I would like to present to you some of the factors used to obtain a guilty verdict, and then you can decide if you would vote to convict or acquit. In the last two episodes of this three-part series, I discussed Lacey Peterson's disappearance and then the discovery of her and her son Connor's remains. I told you of other crimes that occurred in the neighborhood, as well as the fact that there was a lot of satanic activity in the area. Now let's talk about Scott Peterson's arrest. A few days after Lacey and Connor were recovered, Scott was arrested for their murder. On the day of Scott's arrest, he was on his way to play golf at Torrey Pines Golf Course in San Diego with his father and brothers. Scott had been spending more and more time in San Diego since that's where his family lived. His house in Modesto had been broken into and the media was still camped out there. On April 18, 2003, Scott drove to his brother John's house to pick up John's driver's license so he could get discounted greens fees, at the suggestion of his father Lee. Lee was paying for the round of golf that day, so he asked Scott to use John's ID to get San Diego rates. On the way to the golf course, Scott called his brother Joe and told him he wasn't going to be able to come because he was being followed by the media. This conversation was recorded by police and was presented at trial.
Hey, Joe.
Brother, what's up?
I lost them. There's another set got me.
Oh, brother.
I don't think I should come play golf.
I don't want to picture me in the press.
Yeah. Yeah, they know I'm on to them.
Scott, that just sucks, man.
Without revealing they were police, 9 to 10 different unmarked cars followed Scott for over 160 miles for almost 4 hours. He finally decided to go to the club to meet his family as they were finishing their round of golf. It was at this time that police finally decided to pull him over, and he immediately did so. He wasn't headed for the border. He didn't attempt to evade police, although he did attempt to lose the cars behind him, thinking they were reporters. The media began to circulate this story as if police arrested Scott 30 miles from the border, rather than being arrested in San Diego. While both are geographically true, they spun it as a more salacious story. In early February, Scott traveled back and forth to Mexico for work, and police were aware of that trip. He did come back to the U.S., but, of course, no media outlets reported on that. It was also reported that Scott changed his appearance, and again, while true, all facts were not provided. Scott had lost a lot of weight, lightened his hair, and grew a goatee, all to hide from the public and the press since they were all still harassing him. The police, however, had actually spoken to Scott after his appearance change, so they knew what he looked like. As widely reported, Scott had a lot of cash on him the day he was arrested. Over $14,000, as a matter of fact. Obviously, this looked bad to the police, and then to the public. To this day, people still use this detail as, quote, proof against Scott. However, it was ascertained that his mother, Jackie, had mistakenly withdrawn $10,000 from a 10-year-old bank account jointly owned by Jackie, Scott, and Lacey, rather than her own personal account. While at the bank that day, Jackie didn't have a withdrawal slip, so she gave the teller her social security number. The teller chose the incorrect account. As soon as Scott noticed, he called Jackie and she returned the money in cash so the bank wouldn't put a hold on it. That was the day before Scott's arrest, and he hadn't yet had time to redeposit the money. Jackie had also given Scott $8,000 cash to purchase his pickup truck for Scott's brother John. He took $3,600 of that money and bought a used car, in which he was arrested. This explains the cash that Scott had in his possession. I know it can be construed as suspicious, but these were legitimate reasons that investigators were able to corroborate. Scott also had in his possession some Mexican currency. Surely this must prove he was fleeing to Mexico, right? Yeah, no. He had a total of 70 pesos with him left over from his business trip, which converts to about $6.40 in U.S. dollars. Although if that's enough money to go to Mexico, sign me up. My final note on Scott's alleged attempt to flee the country. Scott's attorney, Mark Garagos, mentioned in his trial opening statement that Scott had just paid his car insurance and his income taxes. He filed his tax returns and had not cashed his paycheck. That doesn't seem to be someone ready to leave the country. And if he were going to flee, why wouldn't he have done so before they positively identified Lacey and Connor? Or before they even found their remains? Or for that matter, why return from his February work trip if he were guilty? All of that was circumstantial evidence that, combined with Scott's fling with Amber, convicted him. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle once wrote in a Sherlock Holmes mystery, quote, "Circumstantial evidence is a very tricky thing. It may seem to point very straight to one thing, but if you shift your own point of view just a little, you may find it pointing in an equally uncompromising manner to something entirely different," unquote. That's what circumstantial evidence is. It's evidence that is based largely on inference and uses reasoning. This indirect evidence has a reputation for being weaker and less valid than direct evidence, but that's not correct. A brief lesson on evidence. Direct evidence provides proof about a fact without requiring jurors to make an assumption or to draw an inference. For example, video footage of the suspect committing the crime. Circumstantial evidence indirectly proves a fact or supports a theory. Indirect or circumstantial evidence implies that the defendant was involved in the crime and is typically sufficient to convict a defendant. A confusing point for many is that in a legal sense, most forensic evidence, including fingerprints and DNA, fall under the category of circumstantial evidence. You must draw a conclusion that the suspect was at the scene during the crime to have left that fingerprint or DNA. Don't forget, though, there was no forensic evidence linking Scott to this crime. So, while the circumstantial evidence against Scott was damning, it was all evidence that required inference. Interestingly, I looked up the word inference and saw this example. A person has a diaper in her hand, spit up on her shirt, and a bottle warming on the counter. You can infer that this person is a mother. However, we don't know that, do we? That person could be the babysitter, or an aunt, or even a kidnapper. Do you see the inferences from circumstantial evidence could be incorrect? Okay, let's continue with the case. Another note about finances, police said an additional motive could have been life insurance. Now, Scott and Lacey each had $250,000 policies on each other, and after Lacey went missing, the media reported that Scott took out an additional $250,000 policy on Lacey, which was not at all true. There is no evidence that he ever took out an additional policy. They reported another false rumor, and investigators, knowing it was a lie, told the Roches this information to plant further seeds of doubt. Detectives testified of just that at trial, but the media continued to report that Scott murdered for money. One result that came out of this lie was that in July of 2003, the myth about Scott buying the insurance on Lacey resulted in legislation being passed in California that obligates insurance companies to notify someone if their spouse will gain financially from their death. After Scott's arrest, police transported him back to Modesto, and there was a huge crowd waiting for him. The police had to drive through a mob of people screaming that he was a murderer. I remember seeing children in attendance at this mob scene, and it greatly disturbed me. I thought to myself, what an awful environment for a parent to bring their child to. Scott's family hired Mark Garagos to represent him since he had experience with this type of media frenzy cases. But even he said this was the most media coverage of any trial he had ever been involved in. They were granted a change of venue, but the trial was moved to Redwood City, which was only 50 miles away. 50 miles certainly wasn't far enough, although 500 miles probably wouldn't have been far enough either. 50% of the people that filled out juror questionnaires admitted that they thought Scott Peterson was guilty. My question to you is, how many of the other 50% lied on their questionnaire, saying they didn't have an opinion? Jury selection took 3 months. In my opinion, the final result was biased against Scott, and sometime between the start of the trial and the verdict, a mistrial should have been declared. First, a question was posed to the potential jurors asking if they were opposed to the death penalty, and if yes, they were automatically excused. I think this is an inappropriate question for a jury that is deciding a verdict, since they could now be predisposed to thinking the defendant is guilty. They've already had a seed planted in their mind regarding a punishment, and the trial hadn't even begun. After the trial, the jurors conducted a straw vote, which is an unofficial ballot to see the opinion of the group. The vote was 10 guilty, 2 not guilty. I'm now going to introduce you to the jurors. I'm calling them by their juror number rather than by name. Their names are public at this point, but I thought this might be a little less confusing. Juror number 1 voted not guilty during that straw vote, but after juror discussions, changed his vote to guilty. He stated that Amber Frye's testimony was what turned the tide for him. He felt that the recorded phone conversations and Scott's lies showed Scott's true colors. During his interview for the docuseries, The Murder of Lacey Peterson, he expressed that he didn't regret his guilty vote, but he does have some misgivings about his vote for the death penalty. Juror number 1 seemed logical and impartial and is quoted in Scott's habeas petition that he used his own sense of reasonableness and rationality. He made the comment that Scott didn't show emotion or cry during the trial, but a court analyst pointed out that most of the jurors couldn't actually see Scott during the trial.
As you can see by the setup of how this courtroom is, if you're juror number 6 or you're juror number 12, your view of Scott Peterson is impaired just because of the way that this is set up. The irony of it is that if and when he did have an emotional expression, it was usually turning his back and communicating with his parents in some way, and not one juror would ever be able to see.
A reporter for the Modesto Bee did see Scott with his head down, gulping for air, and crying during the trial. Things the jury couldn't see from their chairs. Juror number 2 consulted with his priest before the trial to see if voting for death in a capital case was acceptable in the eyes of the church. While I understand him doing so, this is another instance where I think he may have already been predisposed to a guilty verdict and already thinking of the sentencing phase. Number 2 was the last holdout voting against death, but eventually changed his mind. Juror number 3 said she believed in innocent until proven guilty. However, she did make the comment that there was something suspicious about Scott Peterson. Juror number 4 was very outspoken and said in the docuseries that he would personally like to execute Scott Peterson. He said that he didn't need to know how the crime happened, but everything added up to guilty for him. Immediately after the trial, he, along with 2 other jurors, gave a very aggressive interview. I felt it was inappropriate for a jury member. Now, there were 3 different juror number 5s. The first was dismissed due to a comment that he said in passing to Lacey's brother Brent in the lobby of the courtroom. He said that he wasn't specifically told not to speak to family, so when he walked between a camera and Brent, he lightheartedly remarked, "I blocked your shot. I guess you won't be in the news today." To which Rocha responded, just as casually, "Well, at least they're not bugging you yet." Now, the media quoted number 5 as saying, "You're going to lose today," but Brent Rocha himself testified under oath that that was not true. Another juror also told the judge that number 5 was discussing the case outside the deliberation room. However, number 5 said that they would all self-correct themselves if and when that happened. This first juror number 5 was leaning toward a not guilty verdict at the time of his dismissal. The second juror number 5 was also the first jury foreman. I say first because this juror was also dismissed. Another juror had attempted to get him removed as foreman, but lost that vote. This juror number 5 took a lot of notes and tried to discuss the case logically, but the other jurors didn't seem interested in participating. He was arguing in favor of a not guilty verdict. Later, the same juror who tried to get him removed as foreman made intimidating remarks towards him, so number 5 asked to be dismissed from service due to fear for his safety. The bullying juror said in an interview that had this number 5 stayed, they probably would have been a hung jury. An annoying statement, since he's the one that intimidated him in the first place. But a third juror number 5 was introduced, and he was on the final jury that convicted Scott, and they did so in less than a day. Juror number 6 became the foreman when the other was dismissed. Number 6 was interviewed on Larry King Live after the trial and was asked by Larry, quote, "How do you think this crime was committed? What happened?" To which number 6 replied, "Can you be more specific?"
Most puzzling about this is, how do you think this crime was committed? What happened?
Can you be a little more specific?
No, you were the jury. You should be specific. How did he do what you judged he did? What did he do?
Well, at some point he decided he wanted to kill his wife, and he killed his wife. He put her in a boat and dumped her body in the bay.
How do you think he accomplished this without witnesses?
Well, more than likely, this was done in his home. And the only witness there that I'd be aware of were perhaps the dog or the cat, and it doesn't appear that they have any comments.
I feel that right there is unjust. A juror, the foreman no less, has no idea how this crime happened, but voted to convict and sentence a man to death. If you have no idea what happened, isn't that reasonable doubt? And let's not forget, there was no evidence in that house that a crime was committed at all. Moving on to juror number 7. There were 2 of them. The first juror number 7 was dismissed during deliberations because she admitted that she researched the case on the internet. Once she was removed, an alternate juror, who was very emotional throughout the trial, took her place. This new juror number 7 walked into the deliberation room and immediately said that Scott was guilty. She remarked that he killed the little man, so let's get this done. Little man was how she referred to Connor during deliberations, her media interviews, and in letters that she wrote to Scott in the year that followed. According to this new juror number 7, the strongest evidence, in her opinion, was the dogs that tracked Lacey Scent. Don't forget the dog failed his certifications. And the recorded phone conversations between Amber and Scott. She was also among those who thought it couldn't be a coincidence that Lacey and Connor were found near where Scott was fishing. But remember, the police told the public exactly where that spot was. Now I, among others, might consider juror number 7 as a stealth juror. A stealth juror usually has a hidden agenda and attempts to be seated on the jury to influence the outcome. They will tailor their voir dire responses or lie to get on a jury. Voir dire is the process of jury selection during which lawyers, a judge, or both question potential jurors to determine their fitness to serve on the jury of a particular trial. In this instance, juror number 7 lied on her voir dire questionnaire. She responded no to the question, "Have you ever been a victim of a crime or a witness to a crime?" She had, in fact, been a victim of a crime twice. Juror number 7 obtained a restraining order against a woman who was threatening her while she was pregnant, and she was also the victim of domestic abuse. Both of those instances would have initiated an exclusion by the defense. This juror made a claim that the domestic violence incident, quote, "did not cross my mind during any portion of the jury selection process or during the trial," unquote. However, she told another juror that she got pregnant by someone who had a girlfriend, and that during her pregnancy, the girlfriend threatened her. This directly contradicts the claim that the incident wasn't on her mind, since she told another juror about it. Her lie may result in a new trial for Scott. Juror number 7 was with number 4 and number 8 when they gave their rather antagonistic interview immediately after trial. During this interview, juror number 7 appears to be angry and almost vindictive. As she turned away, you can see that she called Scott an unflattering curse word.
He is a jerk, and I have one comment for Scotch. You look somebody in the face when they're talking to you.
It was just another day in paradise for Scott. Another day that he had to go through emotions. But he's on his way home, Scott figured. Guess what, Scotty?
San Quentin's your new home.
And it's illegal to kill your wife and child in California.
In an odd twist, juror number 7 has written several letters to Scott while he's been on death row. These letters are referenced in Scott's habeas petition, stating she, quote, disclosed an obsessive interest in the death of the petitioner's unborn child, unquote. I've read some of these letters, and they are bizarrely friendly. She drew smiley faces, told him she looked forward to hearing from him, and let him know she was worried about him when she didn't hear from him. She was admitted to a psychiatric hospital for a bit and seemed to almost use Scott as a therapist of sorts. Moving on to juror number 8. Some of the things known about him were that his roommates thought Scott Peterson was guilty, and his ex-wife sought an order of protection against him during their divorce. He was another very outspoken juror, and he allegedly bullied other jurors to the point where the second juror number 5 asked to be released from duty. Another juror stated that he yelled frequently and apparently had his mind made up, often becoming impatient with the rest of the jurors. It appears as though juror number 8 was trying to eliminate any jurors that didn't have the same opinion as he did, and he succeeded in doing so. He went out of his way to get both number 5 and number 7 kicked off the jury. Paula Canny, a legal analyst that watched the trial, was approached during a court break by her neighbor, a local bartender, who told her that juror number 8, along with several other jurors, were seen drinking at his bar before the sentencing phase, laughing and talking about the trial. The bartender told Paula that the jurors were talking about sentencing Scott to death. Because Paula is an officer of the court, she had an obligation to tell the judge, who held a hearing, but the bartender pled the 5th and number 8 remained on the jury. Scott's attorneys felt that the first juror, number 5, was dismissed over a rumor of discussing the case, but number 8 remained even though an officer of the court reported these inappropriate conversations. I feel juror number 8 should have been relieved of his duty since he was intimidating and bullying other jurors. Juror number 9 was the first juror selected. Her first husband had been convicted of a murder, and then he was murdered while incarcerated. She stated she had the ability to be impartial and do what she felt was right, and she seemed to uphold this obligation. It was reported in the media that number 9 teared up when they announced the death sentence. Juror number 10 had a past tragedy involving the death of a child, but neither side exempted her from jury service. Sadly, she lost her almost 2-year-old son in a tragic accident almost 18 years before. She said after trial that she identified with the Roches since she knew the grief that came with losing a child. Juror number 10 said she often needed to pull over on the way home from trial since she was crying so hard. I would think that in hindsight, the defense might have wanted to excuse her from service. Juror number 11 seemed to come to court and do the task she was assigned. She stands by her guilty verdict, but admits that sentencing was difficult, since both families lost their children that day. Local reporter Gloria Gomez saw this juror wink at Lacey's mother as the jury entered the courtroom with a verdict. Juror number 12 was a social worker that used to work with child abuse cases, then moved on to work with adoptions. I would think her work experience might have swayed her thinking a bit, but she seemed as though she was able to do the task assigned. It was reported in the book that several of the jurors collectively wrote that number 12 was crying when the foreman was filling out the paperwork for the court. Okay, you've met the jurors, now let's touch on a few things from the trial. At the start of the proceedings, some jurors felt the defense was strong and the prosecution was fumbling. They said Mark Garagos came out swinging but seemed to fizzle toward the end. One of the things that Garagos himself regrets is not calling all of the witnesses that saw Lacey walking Mackenzie the morning of her disappearance. He told the jurors he would do so in his opening statements, but then he didn't follow through. The witnesses themselves seemed shocked they weren't called as well. He also didn't call any witnesses from the marina that saw Scott launch his boat or while fishing. Major fail on the part of the defense, since they could have testified there was no body in the boat. I thought it was important that the manufacturer of Scott's boat testified about the stability testing that they conducted. They spoke about testing completed in an indoor pool, so without wind, currents, waves, and the like. Scott weighed approximately 200 pounds and Lacey about 150. The prosecution also alleged that Scott had tied at least 4 8-pound anchors to Lacey. So, in total, those, along with Scott and Lacey, weighed at least 380 pounds. In order for Scott to have dumped Lacey into the water, all of that weight would be at the edge of the small aluminum boat, causing it to either capsize or sink. The defense team also conducted several failed attempts at recreating the scenario. A guy playing Scott in the recreations threw 100-pound weights over the side of the boat, and it capsized each time. The judge denied these exhibits from being entered into evidence, stating the conditions weren't identical enough. I felt that it would have been a convincing demonstration for the jury to have seen. What the judge did allow, though, was for the jurors to get into the trailered boat on dry land and attempt to tip it. That's not even close to the actual conditions the boat would have been in. A trailered boat is much more stable than one floating in water. In the end, I think that Amber's testimony and her taped phone conversations with Scott were what really did him in. That and the media coverage. The jury felt that if Scott was a liar and was unfaithful to his pregnant wife, he must be capable of murder as well. In his closing argument, Mark Garagos informed the jury, quote, "You're not supposed to just decide this case on whether or not you like Scott Peterson," unquote. But it appeared they did just that. I mentioned earlier how quickly the verdict came back after the third juror number 5 was seated. Well, he was seated on a Thursday afternoon, and the verdict came back on Friday morning. Unfortunately, the defense team and the family didn't think they would decide so quickly, so Mark Garagos went back to L.A., and Scott's father and sister flew home to San Diego. Scott's own lawyer wasn't in the courtroom when the guilty verdict was read. After the clerk read the word guilty, cheers from the crowd outside could be heard in the courtroom.
"We find the defendant, Scott Lee Peterson, guilty of the crime of murder of Lacey Denise Peterson."
Even worse, as Scott's mother and sister-in-law were leaving, the mob was shouting things at them like, "I hope they fry your son," and "burn in hell." On the day the jury came back with the death sentence, there were more cheers from the crowd. Whether you think Scott is guilty or not, I find it revolting that they cheered about someone else's potential death. In 2019, California's governor, Gavin Newsom, ordered a moratorium on the death penalty. However, executions had already been frozen by a federal court order since 2006, and that freeze will continue even after Newsom's moratorium is terminated. So what's the status of Scott's case today? He, along with his attorneys, have maintained his innocence for the past 18 years. In August of 2020, Scott's death sentence was overturned due to a jury selection error. Remember when I discussed that a question was posed to the potential jurors asking if they were opposed to the death penalty? And if yes, they were automatically excused? Well, because the judge didn't first determine whether they could put their beliefs aside and follow the law, he wrongly excluded those jurors. Scott's guilty verdict still stands, at least for now, and the county had intended to retry the penalty phase to reinstate the death penalty. However, Scott also has a habeas petition pending for a jury misconduct issue, so the death penalty phase is being postponed until that issue from the habeas is decided. The juror misconduct issue stems from the claim that that second juror number 7 allegedly lied on her juror questionnaire. Remember that she was a victim of a crime not once but twice, and answered no to that specific question. If the judge concludes that juror misconduct took place, it could overturn Scott's conviction and grant him a new trial. If that happens, the penalty phase would be moot. If Scott is granted a new trial, the witnesses that didn't testify the first time could be presented, including the very important testimony by the mailman. This case has been compared with the case of Dr. Sam Shepard. Dr. Shepard was convicted of murdering his pregnant wife in a trial that resulted in a media frenzy in the 1950s. The doctor, much like Scott, had a mistress, and again, like Scott, he denied this but later admitted it when confronted with her statement of the affair. Sounds pretty familiar, right? Also similar, the adverse media coverage denied him due process. The television show and movie, The Fugitive, was loosely based on the true story of Dr. Shepard. Mark Garagos actually argued for separate juries for the guilt and sentencing phases of the trial and cited Shepard v. Maxwell while doing so. The motion was denied. He argued, quote, "We've got what I consider to be one of the most unique situations that I can think of since the Shepard trial, in terms of the publicity and how the publicity has affected this case," unquote. Shepard v. Maxwell was the 1966 U.S. Supreme Court case that examined the rights of freedom of the press, as outlined in the First Amendment, when weighed against the defendant's right to a fair trial, as required by the Sixth Amendment and the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. In an 8-1 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court found that Shepard did not receive a fair trial, stating that while freedom of expression should be given great latitude, it must not be so broad as to divert the trial away from its primary purpose, adjudicating matters in an objective, calm, and solemn courtroom setting. The court concluded in Shepard's case that the trial judge should have either postponed the proceedings or transferred them to a different venue. It held that Dr. Shepard had been deprived of a fair trial because of the Roman holiday atmosphere surrounding the trial and because the judge failed to minimize the prejudicial impact of massive publicity. In Scott's case, there was certainly that same atmosphere, which was more similar to a spectator blood sport than a criminal trial. Scott Peterson didn't receive a fair trial. Scott was tried by the media and public opinion way before he walked into that courthouse, thus ensuring everyone involved with the case had already judged him harshly. Personally, I lean more toward a not guilty verdict, which puts me in a minority. There are definitely two sides of this case. One is the view told by the media back in 2002 to 2004. The other, a more unbiased perspective, comes from researching about what actually happened. So I challenge you to do exactly that. Continue researching about this case and decide if you think it's possible that Scott Peterson really is innocent. Don't forget, here in the United States, it's innocent until proven guilty. And I just don't think the state proved it beyond a reasonable doubt.